I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology, as well as new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Folta, and today we'll be talking about pollinators. And we have with us Dr. Rick Besson, who is an extension professor of entomology from the University of Kentucky and has a great deal of experience both with insects and specifically with pollinators. So welcome to the program, Rick.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to talk to you. So let's start by maybe you could give the listeners a kind of a description of your experience in the whole issues of pollinators, and particularly focusing on the last few years where I think you've been a major player in the state's focus on how to improve pollinator populations.
Well, you know, pollinators are they're receiving a lot of concern lately. I think this really came to a head back in 2015. The White House issued a paper talking about the need to improve pollinator health. And when we talk about pollinators, it's not just, you know, honeybees, and it's also a lot of wild pollinators. There's many species of wild bees. There's also the monarch butterfly that a lot of people don't really think of as a pollinator, but it is. Now, some of the goals established in this 2015 White House plan were to reduce the overwintering losses of honeybees. Right now, they're at unacceptable levels, somewhere between 30% and 40% is what we typically see.
Lost during the winter, right?
The overwintering losses. Mm-hmm. And okay, we would like to reduce that to about 15%. That's considered to be the historical average and acceptable levels. They also wanted to increase the amount of land available for quality pollinator forage, and to increase that to, I think the number was about 15 million acres. And then with monarchs, they wanted to reverse this dramatic trend in the loss of monarchs and increase the populations to about 225 million monarch butterflies in their overwintering sites.
And their overwintering sites, actually, I'm jumping ahead, but maybe you could say just a little bit more about your particular role, because I know you've been here in Kentucky, been one of the keystones, if not the keystone, in this, how Kentucky responded to the pollinator protection plan.
Okay, well, what happened is that, you know, the White House issued this paper, and then the EPA has requested each of the states to develop their own pollinator protection plan. I think it's really great that we were given the opportunity as Kentucky to develop our own plan, because we could develop a plan that's particularly tailored to our needs, our resources, and we weren't dictated what we needed to do, but we could create one and bring people together so that we could organize our own plan. The lead agency with this was the Kentucky Department of Agriculture, but University of Kentucky, as well as Kentucky State University, played major roles in terms of the organization with this. And through the process, we brought, I would say it was between 30 and 40 different governmental agencies, non-governmental organizations, and groups together. It really surprised me. I thought when we were going to do this pollinator protection plan, we bring together, you know, commodity groups, government agencies, you know, other citizens groups together. I thought there'd be a little bit of conflict, you know, in terms of people wanting to impose restrictions on other groups and things like that. I could not have been further from being correct. That everyone recognized the importance of pollinators. That was unquestioned by any group here. And, you know, even with honeybees, everyone unanimously felt that they're an integral part of agriculture, just like any other aspect of agriculture, and as well as monarchs. And there's a number of groups, and even within our own Kentucky Pollinator Protection Plan, there is a section for monarch butterflies as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the outcomes of our Kentucky Pollinator Protection Plan is that we came up with best management practices for people that have bees, so beekeepers, best management plans for pesticide applicators, and best management plans for landowners as well, and how they can encourage high-quality forage and promote pollinators on their property.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, thanks, Rick, for that good overview. And it's I'm pleased to hear, even though we work for the same university, I didn't know how smoothly this process went. I'm sure there was a lot of there were challenges along the way, but it sounds like a very positive experience.
I think it was very positive. And one thing I think that was one of the intangible things that came out of the process is a lot of these groups that have very different agendas and objectives really came together and got a much better understanding of some of the other groups that were involved in the process. Yeah. And so I think it was a very positive process.
Well done. So let's drill down a little bit. The monarch butterfly is one of the topics that I know listeners will be interested in, because there have been over the years some concerns about particular applications of genetic engineering that may impact the monarch population. So for the benefit of the listeners that aren't familiar with the biology and the migration of the monarch butterfly, maybe you could start by giving us an overview of that.
Okay. The monarch is really, I'm an entomologist, so you have to forgive me if I get a little bit carried away with this, but it's a fascinating animal.
It is.
And, you know, it has this really unique way of migrating. So if you think about, you know, during the summer in North America, we have monarchs that are in the West and throughout the Midwest and East Coast, and these populations don't overwinter in the areas that you normally see them. So what they do in the late fall, they begin migrating southward. And so there's three distinct populations, you know, one on the west, one on the east coast, and then the large one in the central United States in the Midwest. And let me focus in on the one in the central United States. So they begin migrating southward, and they will end up just in a few very isolated populations in central Mexico.
So they begin migrating southward in what, in late August, early September?
Yeah,
in our area.
Yeah, actually, in our area, they come through in September.
Okay.
Generally, but as you get further north, that migration starts even earlier.
Okay.
And it's not just individuals that are migrating, but they'll actually go through several generations. In a typical year, you can have 4 to 5 generations of monarch butterflies. And so that it's the overall populations we talk about migrating, not necessarily individuals that will make it through the whole process. Mm-hmm. And so they migrate south, and you know, a couple hours from Mexico City, up high in the mountains of Mexico, we have these isolated populations, and there's a number of these, but these are characterized by, you know, an acre or multiple acres of monarchs that cling to these trees. And it's really fascinating. I took a group of graduate students down a few years ago.
Wow.
And we observed this.
Nice.
And, you know, you see monarchs, you know, that are 4 or 5 butterflies deep just clothing these trees. I mean, it's like a very heavy monarch coat on these individual trees. Mm-hmm. And they get down there in you know, December, January. By this time of the year, late February, they're going to begin migrating back to the United States. And again, they'll have a generation that occurs in the southeastern United States early in the spring, and then they keep flying northward. They'll have another generation, you know, in the Midwest. And so really fascinating. But the problem has been with the monarch butterflies is that the area covered by the monarchs in their overwintering sites in Mexico has dropped precipitously. And so that's been a concern with a lot of people, what's happening to the monarch butterflies. Because it is such a fascinating insect. It's a beautiful insect. It's one way that, you know, the average gardener can keep their finger on the pulse of the environment, you know, seeing the monarchs that fly through the yard. Mm-hmm. So it is really an interesting insect.
Yeah, you used, in preparation for this interview, we talked a little bit about the monarch, and you used the word iconic. It's an iconic American insect, and I've experienced, well, American and Mexican, and I've experienced that all over and over with all kinds of people, particularly gardeners, as you know, who may be outside and see their first monarch of the season. So.
Yeah, I guess when I use the word iconic American insect, I'm talking about, you know, North American insect.
Right, yeah. Of course. So because Talking Biotech focuses to a great extent on genetic issues and biotechnology issues, there are two issues that where there's been some concern about biotechnology impacts on the monarch butterfly populations. And maybe we could start first with the BT crop issue that goes back a number of years. Perhaps you could describe that for the listeners and describe what the outcomes were of those investigations.
Okay, I mean, there's been a lot of concern about the monarch butterflies, and let me just say that we cannot for certainty today say exactly what the factors are that are impacting the populations. But there's been a number of studies that have come up over the years that have tried to tease apart certain aspects of this.
Sure.
You know, one of the first things that came out was a paper a number of years ago where they fed monarch larvae some of the pollen from some of the early BT corn events that were out on the market. Those events are not currently out on the market anymore.
And by BT, we mean insect resistant.
The insect resistant corn that had the had a trait from a soil bacterium, mm-hmm. and it's a naturally occurring soil bacterium. It's been used. That same bacterium produces a naturally occurring insecticidal protein. We've used that same protein in sprays for organic production since the 60s, and that they moved the gene or the trait from the soil bacterium into corn, and we found that, you know, corn could protect itself from certain types of caterpillars, and you know that was really revolutionary to control the European corn borer, which at the time was a huge problem in the United States. It was one of our billion-dollar pests. We either we lost a lot of money due to its feeding and damage, and we also spent a lot of money on its control. And together, those added up to $1 billion a year. So it was a key pest. And when the BT corn first came out, this insect protected corn, we found it gave extremely high levels of control versus European corn borer. But one of the early studies showed that it's not completely selective on the insects that it can impact. And they demonstrated through some laboratory studies that if they put the BT corn pollen onto milkweed plants, then fed these plants to monarch caterpillars, that they could get some kill of the monarch caterpillars.
And that study got a lot of attention when it was published.
A tremendous amount of attention. I feel the study was interesting in some ways, but it showed us that, you know, some of these technologies are not as selective and focused as we may think. But there was also a number other aspects to the studies that showed that in the field that a lot of those concerns weren't as significant as were initially brought up in that paper.
Because, as you noted, the original study where they fed the milkweed containing the pollen from the corn was actually done in the lab, and so they were exposed, if I'm not mistaken, the monarch caterpillars were exposed to doses of this BT protein or the Cry protein that would not occur in the field.
Correct. That in that particular paper, they didn't report on the doses, but you know, speaking with some of the authors, it sounded like the doses were quite high. And so there was a number of factors that in the field could potentially reduce the exposure of the monarchs to the pollen. One is wind and rain that would wash the pollen off the leaves of the milkweed. The other aspect is that by using the BT corn, producers are using less broad-spectrum insecticide. So there's, you know, we're replacing one technology with another technology. We're not adding to it. So overall, the EPA determined after a number of other papers came out that the overall effect of BT corn pollen on monarchs should be positive rather than negative. But it, as you understand with research, it took a number of years for all these other studies to come out and demonstrate that.
Yeah.
But I think there was still some initial good information with that original study. It just sort of opened our eyes that, you know, when we do have these new technologies, they need to be managed.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this one does have a if anything, it's thought to have a positive effect on monarch populations. Not a hugely monarch, but hugely positive, but it is a positive effect.
So, yeah, I see your point. That was a good example of how an issue arose, and follow-up studies were necessary to really evaluate that concern to see if it was going to hold water or not. And it sounds like it does not, but that wasn't clear at the time. And so we did the right thing in the scientific community. We went ahead and did the research and found the answer.
One aspect of science is that we need to criticize things and from a scientific point of view. And the wheels of research do turn slower than some would like. But we are able to ferret out these answers over time.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great point to take a break. And we're going to come back after this short break because there's quite a bit more to discuss on pollinators. And so we're talking to Dr. Rick Besson, Extension Professor from the University of Kentucky. And we'll come back in a few minutes to talk about that. Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Today, a note about auto wrecks, podcasts, and happy endings. A note to the Talking Biotech Podcast comes from Jenny from Bemidji, Minnesota. She says that she was listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast while driving late on a snow-covered country road. She hit a patch of black ice and ended up losing control of her vehicle, rolling and landing upside down. She was unable to call for help as she was unable to find her phone. But wherever it was, it continued to play the Talking Biotech Podcast. She was trapped there for over an hour, cold but unharmed. Thank goodness for airbags. She wrote, "I closed my eyes and listened to the podcast. Kevin and Paul kept me company until help arrived." She was able to enjoy two complete episodes of the Talking Biotech Podcast and said that the soothing messages of science made a desperate time much more pleasurable. Thank you for letting us know, Jenny, and proud to be your podcast Jaws of Life. Share your experiences or interests with us at talkingbiotech@gmail.com. And now, back to the podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast with Dr. Rick Besson from the University of Kentucky. He's an extension professor with really a vast amount of experience with pollinators. And so we're pleased that you're here, Rick, sharing your knowledge.
Well, thank you, Paul.
So we've talked about the influence of BT or insect-resistant crops on the possible influence on the monarch butterfly. Let's turn our attention to glyphosate tolerance. And glyphosate, for those that aren't aware, is the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup. And so Roundup-ready crops were created several decades ago that were essentially tolerant to the application of this herbicide, and really the weeds weren't. So that's been good in many ways for producers who've used them, but there's been some concern about how the very good weed control that this program provides can eliminate populations of the food base of the monarch butterfly, the certain species of milkweeds, and maybe impact be a factor in monarch populations, both in the United States and in Mexico. So that's a complex topic. I've kind of framed it, but Rick, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, it is a very complex topic. And let me say to begin with that I'm not sure that we have all the research to give definitive answers right now. It looks like we have some idea of what's going on out there. But, you know, the glyphosate-tolerant crops, you know, corn and soybeans, notably in the Midwest, that they have provided very, very effective weed control programs that are economical for producers. And the end result is that we see, from a producer point of view, much cleaner fields than we have in the past. We have fewer what farmers would call weed escapes in the field.
Okay.
Now there are some issues that are cropping up now with some weeds developing some resistance or tolerance to the Roundup. And so, but in terms of monarch butterflies, monarchs feed on, as larvae, only on one group of plants, milkweed species. And milkweeds have been a weed pest in producers' fields. And through the use of these glyphosate-tolerant crops, we're seeing fewer milkweeds in these fields. And so we have reduced, to a certain extent, milkweed populations within production fields.
And that's from the perspective of a grower. That's kind of what you want, is to reduce weed pressure.
Weeds are pests that can steal the profitability and yield potential from growers. And so, you know, from a grower perspective, that's a very good thing. You know, from a monarch perspective, if they're hunting for milkweeds in this large cornfield or this large soybean field, they may not find the milkweed out there that they may have found, decades ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, So you've framed it rather well here, Rick. What do you think? What's the role of that? Because it's plausible, and I've always recognized that as a plausible possible connection between genetic engineering, Roundup ready crops, that is, and monarch populations. What does the current research show?
Okay, so the research on really we need to drill down to ask the question: why are monarch populations declining? Is it because of habitat loss in their summer feeding grounds? Is it because of habitat loss where they're overwintering? Mm-hmm. Is it because of some unknown disease or parasite, which I haven't seen any information to indicate that. But, you know, as an entomologist, these are questions we ask.
Mm-hmm.
And or could it be through maybe not habitat loss, but, particular climate impacts mm-hmm. on the populations? Some years we have some really nasty weather situations that occur in their overwintering grounds that can kill a substantial number of monarchs.
Severe storms,
wet rains that freeze on the monarchs and things like that. Mm-hmm. They don't react well to that.
Okay.
We're also very much concerned about illegal logging that's occurring around some of these overwintering sanctuaries. And literally, we're talking just a handful of acres.
Yeah.
And so taking out just a few trees can have a large impact on these populations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what has also received a lot of attention is the habitat loss
And by habitat loss, you mean you're referring to milkweed plants, am I right?
I'm talking about habitat loss for the larvae occurring in, you know, the United States and Canada and places like that with these newer technologies we have from some of these biotech crops. And that's created a very, I'm looking for the word here, a strong push for people to plant, you know, monarch way stations and things like mm-hmm. that for homeowners and communities to try and increase the forage for that. Now, you asked me, what is the science mm-hmm. saying about this? And I have to say there's lots of ongoing studies right now. We don't know, but sometimes we have to draw conclusions even with limited information available. And, you know, one of the more recent studies that I've seen that's just come out has indicated that it may not be habitat loss in their summer larval feeding grounds that's impacting the populations, possibly as much as what's going on in their overwintering habitats in Mexico. What they're seeing is the area covered by the monarchs in Mexico is dropped precipitously. And if you look at how their populations move northward, that is more correlated with the drops in population numbers than the size of the populations that are moving southward in the fall. And so that is an element that may show that what's going on between years in Mexico may be a very important factor, and it may not just be a single factor, but that mm-hmm. seems to be a very important factor.
So at this point, tentative indications that the overwintering populations in Mexico and the factors that affect those is maybe the biggest factor as compared to the milkweed populations that are along the way as the monarch migrates north. Have I summarized it accurately?
Although I'm not sure we're to the point where we can say it's the biggest factor.
Okay.
But it does look like it's a very important factor.
Okay.
And one thing I don't want to drive any of the listeners to conclude that I still think planting monarch way stations is very important for a number of reasons. One, you know, it does provide very, very good forage, and we're getting production of monarchs from these way stations. I think it's also good for, you know, homeowners and communities because they feel like they're empowered to do something mm-hmm. with an environmental issue. Mm-hmm. And they get a lot of buy-in and ownership with the monarchs they see when they're going out there and they're doing something positive mm-hmm. for this pest. And so I don't want to dismiss the value of continuing to do conservation in North America.
Gotcha. Yeah. And as my fiance is a social scientist, and she would precisely repeat that same point, Rick. It's very important for people to feel like they're making a difference. You and I perhaps don't have the influence on what happens in Mexico, but we can do something about what happens locally, and that can contribute to the process in all the ways that you've indicated.
Yeah, and monarch way stations and other conservation efforts are still increasing in North America, mm-hmm. and you know, hopefully what we do with conservation in this area, in this region, can have a positive effect on the populations overall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if there's things that are outside of our control, such as climate and things like that, that you know, maybe we can offset some of that with some of our conservation efforts.
Very good. So, honeybees, I want to make sure that we don't miss the chance to tap into your experience and knowledge on this very important issue. In fact, you've been a beekeeper for many years and many times in your life. So, tell us about honeybee decline.
Honeybee decline has been a concern, particularly since 2006. And since 2006, we've had documented honeybee declines that have been between 30 and 40%. And how we measure that are the number of colonies that begin the overwintering process in the fall and the number of colonies that are alive in the spring. And so that's how we measure, you know, overwintering losses, is the drop in number that we get during that period. And it's been unacceptable, and a lot of people think it's unsustainable if we continue this 30 to 40% loss. Now, I have to say, in reality, it's not an overall 30 to 40% loss every year, because we're able to recover some of those numbers during the year. We can increase the number of colonies through proper management. But generally, these losses have been high. It's been difficult for many commercial beekeepers. You know, it's their livelihood. And, you know, it's been a concern. What can we do to reverse this? Now, I don't want anyone to think that this is due to biotech crops. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into overwintering losses. For a number of years, we had colony collapse disorder. It hasn't been observed since 2013. There's a very specific set of symptoms you see with it, and we haven't seen that. We're still seeing losses. People have been concerned about pesticides. They've been concerned about a number of bee diseases, notably a whole host of viruses that the bees get. But really, one of the major factors has been varroa mite, that it's a relatively new parasite of bees. It's been in the country since the early 90s, and not only does it cripple colonies on its own, but it also transmits some of these viruses that impact bees. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of BT crops and honeybees, really the BT crops are not toxic to honeybees. No one's that I'm aware of has ever demonstrated any toxicity. You know, bees will collect pollen. You know, they can collect pollen from corn in some situations. They can collect nectar from soybeans and things like that. And these biotech crops, I don't think directly pose any hazard at all to honeybees.
Okay.
But to a certain extent, you know, when we have cleaner fields, you know, the glyphosate-tolerant crops, we're creating situations where there may be a little bit less forage for the bees in you know, these corn fields and these soybean fields, the flowering weeds that would be out there
Them.
Things like, you know, clovers and all these other things that could have potentially in the past been weed escapes for the bees.
Okay.
But
so that was a rather categorical statement. You don't think that biotech crops pose any hazard to the honeybees. And the reason why that caught my attention is because I've known you and worked with you since 1991 when you first came. And I'm telling you, listeners, this is an individual that's going to speak very carefully. And so it sounds like a rather categorical conclusion that we can rule out any role of biotech crops on honeybee declines.
Well, I guess just to speak carefully, what I was talking about was like direct toxicity to the bees.
You know,
so when they feed on pollen from genetically engineered crops, you know, biotech crops, either corn or soybeans, I have never seen any studies that shown that those crops have been toxic to bees. I think they do, in some of their technologies, indirectly affect bees, just because you get cleaner fields with fewer flowering weeds. And so that's a very indirect effect.
So worthy of note, but again, it's sort of that same thing as glyphosate-tolerant crops in general, it's growers are going to seek good weed control.
Yeah, but in terms of the overall impact on the bees, I think it would be very marginal at most.
Gotcha.
Extremely marginal at most.
So there are a complex of causes, and you're not the first respected entomologist. In fact, that seems to be a pattern from what I see from a distance as a plant pathologist and not an entomologist, that respectable entomologists often conclude that it's a really complex topic, and in terms of understanding and teasing apart the multiple causes that may be involved.
Yes, yeah, it is very difficult. You know, it may be a complex of interactions. You know, you could even throw in some things like bee genetics may be a factor in there. Nutrition can play an important role. Pesticides, and you know, we have lethal effects from pesticides. We have sublethal effects on pesticides. When we start mixing fungicides and insecticides, there's been concern about synergistic effects when we combine these things, that the impact from the combination is greater than the impact from each product alone. And so there's a lot of things. Some of these things are outside our control. You know, others are under our control. For example, pesticides, that's something that we do. We can't control the weather, but we can control, you know, how we use pesticides in the environment.
So you brought up pesticides, and I can't miss this opportunity once again to ask you an important question. There is a class, listeners, that of insecticides called the neonicotinoid insecticides, and they have been blamed for bee losses in many contexts. I don't presume to know what the good science, the credible science shows, but I'm talking to somebody that does. So can you comment about the neonicotinoids, what you know?
Do you have a few days? Some of the neonicotinoids, first of all, I hate painting with a wide paintbrush, that neonicotinoids is a class of chemistry. There's a number of different active ingredients, and each of the active ingredients is fairly unique on itself. And, you know, some of them are very, very toxic to honeybees in terms of acute toxicity. You know, we're not talking parts per million or parts per billion. We're actually down at parts per trillion in terms of their toxicity.
Very toxic.
Very toxic.
Wow.
You know, I talk to some of the grower groups that I want to protect bees, and I say these are ultra toxic.
Yeah.
That's my own category.
I like that.
And then there's others that have much reduced toxicity. So they are very different. You know, they've done a number of studies in the lab, and, you know, they've shown how toxic they can be. A lot of the field studies have shown contrary results. That's because what occurs in the field, you know, you have to deal with bees' behavior. If they get into something they don't like, that they shift their foraging patterns and things like that. So often it's very difficult to reproduce these things in the field. What I try and point out to the grower groups that I work with, that, you know, when we talk about risk, and here we're talking about risk of pesticides to honeybees, and I'm not just talking about just the neonicotinoids, but, you know, any pesticide to honeybees, that risk is really a combination of a few things. And one of the things is toxicity of the product you're going to use. And, you know, it's unquestionable that some of these can be very toxic. But the other aspect is exposure. And you really have, it's the combination of a toxic material and exposing the honeybees to it. And so, you know, with our growers, I say, well, you know, if you're going to use some of these products in a situation that the bees are not going to be exposed to it, you know, there's not going to be much risk. And then there's other situations where there's a high likelihood of exposure. You know, when you put these onto crops that are flowering or just before they flower, that's when you're going to increase the exposure. And in those situations, then you really have to manage the toxicity. You have to find things that are going to be not as toxic just because you're going to expose the bees to it. And, you know, it's not just the neonicotinoids. We have plenty of insecticides that are toxic to bees. And I would paint with a wide paintbrush to say, you know, when we're in high exposure situations, we need to be really careful about what we expose these critically important pollinators mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. And that could be fungicides, it could be insecticides, it could be some of the adjuvants, the things that producers will mix with the insecticides so they get better control out of it. Or I should say mix with the pesticides so they get better control. But they need to think about situations where they can potentially expose honeybees. Then they need to manage those products when there is going to be substantial exposure.
It sounds like you're saying you wouldn't single out the neonicotinoids for special concern, recognizing, of course, that certain members of the group are highly toxic to honeybees, but rather you want to make sure growers understand that the exposure part of the equation is the honeybee being exposed to the pesticide that I'm about to apply. That's the part of the equation you don't want to get lost in these discussions.
I think it's probably the critical part of the conversation. You know, how do we manage these products? Because the neonics have lots of great benefits to them. Mm-hmm. They're very effective at controlling pests. They have low mammalian toxicity, which I think is extremely important. As
mammals.
As a mammal. And so, you know, I hate to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Uh-huh. And, you know, if we were to lose the neonics, you know, we would go back to a lot of older chemistry that is also highly toxic to bees. Maybe not as toxic, but we can see some problems. And so, you know, exposure, we reduce exposure by not applying toxic materials to plants that are in bloom that bees are going to forage from, and that could be the crop plant. It could be a weed that is also out in the field. We can reduce exposure by not applying pesticides on windy days where those sprays are going to drift over colonies. We've seen bee kills in Kentucky due to spray drift with insecticides. We don't want to get sprays that drift and contaminate water sources mm-hmm. for bees. And so there's a lot of ways that we can try and manage this mm-hmm. exposure. But I think there's a lot that can be done on the management aspect to make sure that we're using these things with proper stewardship.
Good. Well, you've given us quite a bit to think about, Rick, so thanks for that. And is there anything more you'd like listeners to know about the pollinator issue in general or specifically?
Well, you know, I'm one that firmly believes in science. You know, science sometimes is slow when we can get the answers to this. And I realize that science can change over time. You know, studies come out almost on a daily basis. We look at the studies, we interpret the results of those studies, and we put that in context with all the other scientific literature that has already been published. And so it does evolve over time, sometimes slowly, but it does evolve.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Good point. And so if they want to find out more about your extension program, where should they go?
Well, I have a website in the Department of Entomology at the University of Kentucky. They can check me out there.
Good, and we'll put that link into the on the website for Talking Biotech. So appreciate it. So, Rick, once again, thanks for your time and your expertise. It's really a special treat to have you on the program.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.